All right, good morning. Welcome to Web3 Wednesdays, where we dive into some of the complex and nuanced topics in Web3 and crypto at large so that you can stay ahead of the curve. So today I'm joined by a repeat guest, Lewis Cohen. He's one of my favorites across the legal space, and he's the co-founder of a firm, DLX Law. They wrote a piece that was informative across the space a number of months ago, The Ineluctable Modalities of Securities Law, and I believe, as we may find out here in a moment, that that may have actually informed some recent actions across the space. So the context of the conversation today is none other than the Ripple case. The Ripple case has been ongoing for a number of years, and it's been at the forefront of a number of discussions, both on the commercial and the legal side of Web3. So with all of that, I want to welcome Lewis here today, and I'm really excited to dive into this, Lewis.
Hey, Sam, it's great to be back. And as I was saying, you're a fantastic host, and I really enjoy being on your show.
All right, phenomenal. Well, Lewis, I'm stoked to have you here. So let's get into it. High level, what just happened? What are we looking at?
Well, so as at this point, everybody who's even ever heard of crypto is aware, about 2.5 years ago, the SEC sued the big kahuna, Ripple Labs, claiming that Ripple Labs violated federal securities laws when they sold quite a lot, give or take $1.5 billion worth of their XRP token in a variety of different ways. The case took a long and tortured path through the courts. There was a lot of what we call discovery, and there are disputes about the discovery. I suspect most folks are aware. There were questions about a speech given by the then director of the Division of Corporation Finance at the SEC, Bill Hinman, and whether that had an impact. It turned out to be a bit of a MacGuffin. You know, it was like the thing everybody wanted to know what it was. Then when it turned out to know, it wasn't really that important. But nevertheless, it was a bit of a distraction. And eventually, Judge Annalisa Torres of the Southern District of New York heard the case, read the briefs, and issued her decision yesterday. And what she was effectively asked by the SEC on the one hand and the counsel for Ripple Labs and the individual defendants, Brad Garlinghouse and Chris Larson, was, you know, based on the information presented and the facts agreed by the parties, was the law clear on either side? Was the law clear for the SEC that Ripple Labs had violated the law? Was the law clear for Ripple or the individual defendants that they had not violated the law? So that's what the way the litigation process works. If the judge thought that the law was not sufficiently clear and there were more facts that needed to be determined, you'd have a trial. In fact, there may or may not be a trial. We'll get to that in a moment. But basically, she concluded that the law was clear. I'll pause for breath for a moment and then say what she did conclude. I think most of your guests at this point listening today probably are aware, but we'll get into a little bit of detail of what she said and what the impact of that is.
And I think it's really important to frame the conversation around the categories of individuals, entities, et cetera, involved. So, you know, as far as I understand, they listed, you know, three or so different categories, you know, groups here involved. Can you walk through those? Who are the, you know, counterparties here? Which groups are we talking about?
Sure. So, interestingly, unlike earlier cases, and the most prominent earlier cases were the KIK case, KIK, right, which involved, you know, more or less a run-of-the-mill ICO, the Telegram case, which involved a private sale of tokens later to be distributed, in Ripple, the court breaks down the different categories. And she says, well, first there are what she refers to as the institutional buyers. The institutional buyers negotiated directly with Ripple Labs. They understood what exactly they were doing, why they were doing it, and how they were doing it. And although they were sophisticated buyers, apparently they did not have the appropriate exemptions. And so for that category of purchasers, the judge said, hey, Ripple, you did violate the law when you sold tokens to these institutional buyers. We'll get into the whys and wherefores in a moment. But she then breaks out these two other categories. She talks about programmatic sales, which she refers to as that, in which once the XRP token was traded on exchanges, what XRP, what Ripple would do is take periodically some number of tokens and put them onto the exchange for sale into the market. And she notes that with those, what she refers to as programmatic sales, there were already huge amounts of activity in the XRP token. In fact, it was, I think, at some one point the fourth largest digital asset by market value. And so she states that the sales by Ripple were only about 1% of the total market cap. And so that factors strongly into her conclusion that those sales did not violate federal securities law. And that's the part that the crypto community is really talking about and focusing on. The third category is other distributions. And that's where, like many different crypto projects, the token being Magic Internet Money and all, is used to pay for salaries, pay for services, and pay for other things. And interestingly, and perhaps most aggressively, Judge Torres says in those cases that those are also not violating the Howey test for, I think, a bit of a stretch reason, and we'll talk about that as well. Finally, the last group are the sales by the individuals, Garlinghouse and Larson, and there, for various reasons, Judge Torres finds that there are questions of fact, and so that's going to have to either get settled or go to trial. So those are the four categories. Institutional sales, the programmatic sales, generally speaking, to retail persons, the sales or the other distributions, which are kind of like sales, but not for money, for cash. And then finally, the smaller but not insignificant sales by the two individuals.
So first of all, it's fantastic that she did outline it in these categories that are so clear, because I think that as the industry has continued to evolve, we do still see these same categories crop up. I mean, it's almost the same across every project that I can think of. And with respect to those, obviously that second category, this idea of programmatic sales, right? Sales through exchanges, sales to retail, et cetera. This is the one that the whole, you know, community is really indexing on, as you mentioned, quite hard. And in my biggest question, right, is as I read through that brief, right, they talk about programmatic selling in a way that to me seemed to encapsulate both DEXs and SEXs. It didn't seem to distinguish between whether or not the venue was technically decentralized or a centralized entity. It seemed to just say, effectively, so long as you've sold into a bulk of volume high enough so that you effectively have not sold directly to a retail counterparty, there is none of this assumption that you have directly made a trade against some issuer. Effectively. Is that the same way that you would kind of read into it? What's the nuance there that you can see?
No, I think, Sam, you know, that's a insightful and accurate summary. There's nothing in Judge Torres's decision that suggests she would have reach a different conclusion as between sales on a centralized exchange versus a decentralized exchange, or even, you know, potentially off exchange, depending on how it was done. The key thing for her was that there was no knowledge or understanding on the part of the buyers as to who they were buying from or why. They had not been specifically, the buyers had not been specifically solicited by Ripple Labs to buy. They were just part of a flow of assets that were being bought and sold. And as such, she concludes that the purchasers who were buying on the exchange didn't know. If you didn't know you were giving a small, you know, a particular transaction was actually some tokens that had come from Ripple Labs, how could you be relying on the efforts of someone that you didn't even know you're engaged with? I would take it a little bit further myself. This is not exactly how she posed it, although I think for me, and we'll talk about the article you referred to in a moment, but for me, really, I think I would frame it a little more around common enterprise. And again, for those of your listeners, Sam, who don't have the Howey test tattooed on the side of their arm, you know, like I do, it's an investment of money in a common enterprise with a reasonable expectation of profits, primarily from the efforts of others, at least that's the modern version of the Howey test. And you know, the common enterprise element, I think, doesn't quite get enough attention here. But in addition to Judge Torres's focus on the fact that if you're doing these programmatic sales on exchanges, SEXs or DEXs, you don't know who you're selling to. It's also, I think, very difficult to say that you're in a common enterprise if you don't even know who you're in a common enterprise with. When we wrote the article, I'll come back to that in a little while, that was really a key issue there. But I think your summary was spot on.
Okay, and I really do want to get to the article here. So let's do one more question on this, and then I want to move over to your thesis piece. So the last question is kind of a commercial you know, component, which is around exchanges and their relationship with projects, right? How do we see this changing or evolving as we go forward, right? Is there a preference for high float projects, right, which are now less likely to, you know, to be dinged by the SEC potentially as a result of this court case? You know, how do you see that kind of unfolding as it keeps moving?
Sure. So, I mean, I think just to answer your question on a kind of high level point, I think it's completely fair and appropriate for folks in the crypto space to be excited about this decision for a lot of reasons we'll talk about. But I think it also, and look, I'm a lawyer, right? So I'm going to be cautious. I think you need to remember a lot of things. I wouldn't go YOLOing into, you know, some, well, I'm going to do an IBO or an IEO or something like that, because, you know, the judge's decision here is binding law only on its facts and only in the Southern District of New York. The SEC can bring securities law violation cases in any jurisdiction it pleases, more or less. It just needs to find someone who lost money in that jurisdiction. So they can go all around. You can rest assured that the likelihood of the SEC bringing another similar case in the Southern District of New York, at least, you know, unless and until they're able to get this overturned on appeal, is like near zero. So, you know, if you're a project, I wouldn't take like a lot, like, oh, now we can do this, that, or the other thing. I mean, what we certainly tell our clients is, you know, you need to continue to be very cautious, thoughtful, and really do what you're doing already. So I wouldn't necessarily change behavior as of now. However, directionally, are we going in a direction where we can see for the first time, perhaps, an end state that's not quite as, you know, just misguided as what we have today? Yes, but will we change current behavior based on what the judge found? That I would be cautious about.
Okay, I really like that answer, and that does seem to capture the nuance quite well. So where I want to go next is to your piece, to the ineluctable modality piece. We actually did a podcast on this one previously, so listeners who are interested, you should pop over and listen to that one, because it was also a fantastic summary of what, you know, Lewis and the gang have written. So, you know, just as a reminder, could you walk the listeners through it? What was the high level, you know, kind of thesis point here? And then ultimately, how did it tie into this decision?
Sure, Sam, and yeah, maybe you could put a, you know, a link, I'm sure you will, to the prior thing, so I don't really go through.
Yeah, we'll have it down below. Yeah.
Yeah, in major detail. But I think it's important here, especially in the context of now people thinking about the Ripple decision, to just take a step back as to where we had been. So as, you know, people figured out that they could use particularly Ethereum to create new digital assets, they could use those new digital assets to raise capital and start networks. You know, we saw, you know, going back to 2015-16 and then booming as a period you know well, 2017 and 18, where huge amounts were raised through what, you know, whatever term you want to use, let's just say ICO transactions. And the SEC, I think, appropriately said all of those transactions are securities transactions because they meet the four prongs of Howey very easily. What we then saw in 2019 was the then director of corporation finance, the division of corporation finance, who I referred to earlier, Bill Hinman, give this speech. And this speech was really critical because this is where the disjunct started to occur. Many people wondered, well, if ETH itself as a crypto asset was sold at an ICO, and I'm dealing with, you know, is everything in the Ethereum ecosystem kind of tainted by the original sin, as it were, of the Ethereum ICO? And Bill Hinman, you know, and we now know this from all the correspondence that came out in the Ripple discovery, really struggled with this. How do we sort of reconcile this? And without going through the brutal detail, the way he reconciled it was saying, well, look, he kind of, I think, in his mind, split the baby. He said, sure, you know, I'm not expressing a view. In the past, maybe the securities laws were violated when Ether was sold. But today, I think, you know, Ether can be sold without being a securities transaction. And I don't really have to deal with how, when, or where it changed. But something happened. It morphed, right? It was before bad security, now not so much. Now commodity. And so that led into sort of about 4 years of thinking around what is a token, to say, well, tokens start their life as securities because they're sold as securities, and then later somehow they change into non-securities. They morph, they transmute into non-securities. The purpose of the big article, as we lovingly call it, was really to dispute this and to say, you know, I know the mainstream thinking here is that, you know, tokens morph at some point. And here's a fascinating question, which Sam, you may or may not know. Tell me one word that does not appear anywhere in Judge Torres's decision. And it's, people would have told you it's the most important word in the analysis of tokens.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. There was one word that I control left immediately, and there was only one instance, and it's decentralization. Is that the word that
exactly,
you're getting at?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's basically, he says decentralization, then he says et cetera. It's because that's just not that critical. And the gist of our article was decentralization is an incredibly important concept from a philosophical point of view, from a practical point of view, from many points of view, but not from a securities law point of view. Either you have an asset that inherently, you know, is characterized as a security, or you don't. If it's not characterized as security, then it can only be sold in a securities transaction when the factors of a securities transaction are present. And that's really what Judge Torres focuses on. The way the SEC expressed this, it's very interesting. There is a great lawyer named John Deaton who's become a friend. And John had actually made this interesting motion in the XRP case, in the Ripple Labs case, to want to intervene as a defendant. It was like, how do I kind of get engaged in this case? And that's the thing. I'm not a litigator, right? I had no idea. It's like, you know, it's sort of like you put a kick me sign on the back. You're like, what do you mean, intervene?
That sounds really, really wild. Yeah.
But yeah, but it's a thing. It is, it's totally a thing. It didn't work out in this particular case, but it's a great strategy. And because it was a legitimate, you know, motion by John and the people that he was working with, the SEC had to respond. And they wrote a long responsive brief to Judge Torres saying why the SEC did not want this group to intervene as defendants. And there's plenty of good reasons, right? And it kind of is rather dry, but I'm reading this like 11 o'clock on a Friday night. And I remember, like, it's very dry, very dry, very dry. I get to page 24. And on page 24, for whatever reason, the SEC just had to go that one step further. And what they say on page 24 is, and Your Honor, you know, the interveners seem to think that we, the SEC, think that the XRP token is inherently a security. They say, no, we don't. We understand. It's just a number. We get that. But it's the embodiment. It's the embodiment of all the facts and circumstances, everything that's kind of goes on beyond it. And that's why, you know, transactions in that asset are securities transactions. So in our paper, we talk a lot. So it's really important to kind of understand the context here, right? So,
yeah.
So in the paper, we say, well, what is this embodiment theory? Like, where's the footnote that talks about SEC, how you get to this idea that a non-security asset, here, I got a bottle of Snapple iced tea. Does this embody anything? No, it doesn't. You know, how do you get to this idea that this number embodies facts and which promises, by the way, and which facts, which circumstances is it embodying? And how am I supposed to know? And did it stop embodying them? And how am I supposed to know? So in her decision, Judge Torres writes on page 15 of her decision, she said, after referring to the Telegram case, she says, XRP as a digital token is not in and of itself a contract, transaction, or scheme that embodies the Howey requirements of an investment contract. So she really picks up on that and affirmatively rejects the idea that a non-security asset can embody a scheme. And she says, just not how it is. Show me the actual scheme. So now let's come back to the three categories of main sales of XRP. Mm-hmm. Institutional sales, programmatic sales, and the other sales. And let's look at it through this lens. When she looks at it through this lens, she says, okay, the first group, institutional sales, there is a scheme that everybody's aware of. They understand that. Institutional parties, hedge funds, big angel investors, folks like that are coming to Ripple Labs. They're giving money to Ripple Labs. The reason they're doing that is because they expect to be able to sell the XRP tokens they're getting for a profit later. And they are being given directly materials that promise, directly or indirectly. And Judge Torres rejects the idea that you need like an affirmative contract, like I promise to do this. She rejects that concept, right? But the institutional investors are directly in a relationship with Ripple Labs. When she looks at the programmatic sales, she says, well, hang on, something's looking really different here, right? Because those investors who are just buying on the exchanges, they don't even know whether or not they're dealing with XRP, right? So they have a very different position. As to those people, they say the vast majority of individuals who purchased XRP from digital asset exchanges did not invest their money in Ripple at all. Right. Whereas the institutional buyers knowingly purchase Ripple direct XRP directly from Ripple, the retail investors who bought on the exchanges, the economic reality is that those people stood in the same shoes as a secondary market purchaser who did not know to whom or what it was paying its money. And so she focuses on that. There's no embodiment here. She says, and furthermore, as to the various statements that Ripple made, she says, we're not looking, the objective is not one of finding the promises made to investor. She says, the inquiry is an objective one, focusing on the promises and offers made to investors. So in the institutional sales, there were promises made directly to investors. There were discussions between someone from Ripple, someone from the investor. They said, hey, here's what we're going to do. Here's how you're going to make money. In the case of the people buying on exchanges, she says there is no evidence that the programmatic buyers understood that generalized statements made by Larson, Garlinghouse, and others were formal representations of Ripple that they could rely on. Like they said things, like a lot of people say things. One of the examples we give, we filed a brief, Sam, in the case of Ishan Wahi, the guy who was alleged insider trader Coinbase, who traded ahead. And we give five examples there of cases where someone may make statements about their intended actions and where others may rely on those statements and make economic decisions. Like one example, OPEC says, we're going to cut oil production. They make a public announcement of this. And you say to yourself, man, price of oil is going to go shooting up, man. I'm going to buy me some oil, right? And then they don't cut production. And you're like, snap, what the heck? But you didn't give money to OPEC based on a promise that OPEC said, don't worry about it, man. I'm going to cut production, right? You're just like, so what Judge Torres is saying here is, look, if you're just saying you're not buying XRP tokens from Ripple, you're not getting the benefit of promises that Ripple or its officers and directors are making to you. You're just looking at information. In many cases, and I was on a podcast earlier last week, I guess, in which someone who is from the Ripple community said, hey, you know, my mom came to me. And she said, I'd like to buy the top five tokens. And so I arranged to buy them for her, and XRP was one of them. And the guy continued, my mom has no idea who Brad Garlinghouse is. And she has no idea what promises he made. She doesn't know, and she doesn't care. She said, man, I think crypto is like a thing. And I would like to take, you know, $5,000 of my money and put it in crypto. Could you help me?
And this direction, Lewis, around, particularly around the oil example as well, I really, really like that because it gets to the heart of this commodities question, which comes up so often in crypto, right? Which is, you know, we have these fungible assets. One Ripple is equivalent to any other Ripple in any capacity. So, you know, is this not the same as corn, oil, et cetera, everything else? You know, where do you sit alongside that, you know, curve?
Yeah. So I think... it's important to remember, one thing, and Sam, I probably talked about this last time I was on your show, you know, you'll hear a common refrain, which is really just kind of shorthand, well, oranges, you know, are not securities. And, well, sure, oranges are not securities, so but, you know, tokens, in complete fairness to the SEC's position, are also not the same as oranges. Tokens behave differently. They are deliberately finite in supply. And they have these kind of magnified economics, you know, what my friend and former colleague Gabe Shapiro likes to call network equity. It doesn't make network equity a security, but it has a very kind of unique economic characteristic that's different from you know, oranges and other things. But I think I'll give you just another couple of quick examples of this. So, you know, imagine, for example, a speculative buyer that makes a secondary purchase of a parcel of real estate that was part of a large development, right? So I bought, you know, there's like 100 units. I buy one of the units. I have no intention to live there. I think this is going to be a successful development. I'm buying it totally for speculative purposes, right? So I might reasonably expect that the developer of the whole big chunk, right, that owns many of the other parcels. So we all own parcels. They're largely fungible with each other. It's, you know, a big farm or, you know, whatever, right, when you're making a real estate development. I might reasonably expect I have one parcel. The developer's holding, you know, 80 parcels. So I might reasonably expect that the developer of the nearby parcels is going to add features to the development that would increase the value of the parcels over time. The developer might even make statements. There might be an article in the newspaper where the developer says, man, you know, Glengarry Acres is going to, you know, take off, and I'm going to build the most beautiful park and pool, and there's going to be a shopping center. If this thing's going to be incredible. And so I might read that and think, holy cow, my parcel's going to be worth a lot. I might even get another parcel, right? And then the developer doesn't come through. Mm-hmm. I never gave money to the developer, and the developer never made promises to me. I had a reasonable expectation, and I was acting as an investor, but I wasn't an investment contract, right? In the same way that the buyers of XRP in these programmatic sales, the judge found, they're not in an investment contract relationship with anybody, whether it's Ripple Labs or anyone else. They're not giving money to someone who's making promises to them, and they're, you know, relying on that in some way, formally or informally.
That real estate example, that's the first time I've ever heard that too, Lewis. I do like that. This idea of, you know, this kind of nebulous state, perhaps not quite a commodity, you know, not quite a security, somewhere in between where you do have these types of network effects. It is certainly not the same as an orange, right? But it's definitely not the same as a stock either. So it's a hairy question all around. And I think that answers a lot of the questions around the first two categories, right? We have this category of the institutional sales, clearly security sales, right? There's usually a contract that goes along with this, things are sold. Then you have the second category, the programmatic sales, where you don't even know who your counterparty is. How are you possibly raising money of any kind? Then the third category, this idea of, you know, contributors, right? So generally employers, service contractors, etc. What's the read on that?
I gotta say on that one, Sam, as I, you know, kind of said a little earlier, I am concerned. I think that's pretty aggressive. Judge Torres's argument is, look, in order to have an investment contract, you need someone to put capital into a business of some sort. And these people, they're just employees. They're just, you know, business partners in different ways. They're not really putting capital into the investment. Let's see if I can give you a direct quote. So yeah, so she says, the other distributions do not satisfy Howie's first prong of an investment of money. Howie requires a showing that investors provide capital, put up their money, using another quote, provided cash in each case. And then she says, in every case, the purchaser gave up something tangible and definable in terms of consideration in return for an interest that had substantially the characteristics of a security, quoting a famous Supreme Court case called Daniel. And then she writes, here, the record shows that the recipients of the other distributions did not pay money or some tangible or definable consideration to Ripple. To the contrary, Ripple paid XRP to these employees and companies. And as a factual matter, there is no evidence that Ripple funded its projects by transferring the XRP to these people. You know, that's true as far as it goes. For me, the concern here on that, and the reason I'd urge, you know, clients and friends of ours not to go barreling away and doing that, is because there's a clear substitute, right? So, you know, Sam, in a portfolio company you guys invest in, you know, they might say, well, look, I could hire you as a dev for $200,000 a year, or I could save some of my capital, which is pretty sparse here. I'll pay you 50 grand a year, and I'll give you this many tokens. Functionally, you just negotiated the price of those tokens, right? Because if the unsponsored value of your services as a dev was, say, $200,000, and you're only getting paid $50,000, and you're getting X many tokens, then you basically agreeing that the difference between 200 and 50 is, you know, that's the price per token that functionally you're paying. So you're saving the company, you know, in our example, $150,000, you're getting, you know, 150,000 tokens, say, you're basically saying the tokens are worth $1 to you. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say they're not providing capital because they're saving you capital rather than putting more capital in. They're not forcing you to take capital out for something you otherwise needed. I think that's vulnerable on appeal. And I think, you know, we'll see how that plays out. I would certainly urge companies to be very cautious and to treat any disposition of tokens to either business partners, employees, or others, still, if you have any U.S. connection to that transaction, treat that as if it were a securities transaction and be on the safe side.
Yeah, it's a set of lines that I was actually also a little bit shocked to read because traditionally, you know, the idea of consideration is interpreted quite liberally, as far as I understand. And so, you know, the notion that certain forms of consideration in this capacity wouldn't be interpreted the same, it did surprise me a little bit. And, you know, kind of going off that, something that's very pertinent for a large number of projects is the idea of an airdrop. And airdrops are historically very contentious, you know, in the legal space, because you do have situations where it could be interpreted as a quid pro quo, which, you know, might be some form of consideration if I liked and followed your Twitter? Is that payment? I don't know. Maybe to some folks in courts. So, you know, let's, you know, assuming that Torres's decision here holds, you know, what does that change? And would you even read into that at all? Do you think anything should change in that direction?
I would, even if it isn't overturned on appeal in the Second Circuit, I would still be very cautious. I think it's, as your instincts as a non-lawyer are right on target, I would be very cautious about before I barreled into that. And again, as I said earlier, you know, even in the best case that her decision is affirmed on appeal, let's just say best case for crypto, and not taken up by the Supreme Court, so it's done and dusted, that's the law in the Second Circuit. It's not the law in all the other circuits around the country, most particularly the circuit that covers California and the West Coast, you know, Oregon and Washington. The Ninth Circuit is known to be very liberal, generally very sort of, you know, investor friendly, and, you know, can be, you know, readily easy to find things like investment contracts. So you could have the same transaction incur in a lawsuit that, you know, is within the Ninth Circuit and get a very different result, even if her result stands in the Second Circuit. So I absolutely, you know, would agree with that. And until hopefully what this will do, really the key thing here is it motivates Congress to act. At this point, for me, one of the biggest takeaways, Sam, is that, you know, we saw Chair Gensler go before Congress only a few months ago and tell Congress the law is clear. These people just don't want to follow the law. And right, and you know, let's just give him credit that he honestly believed that. Let's just
it's a very strange
that,
set of comments. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just no longer the case. You cannot truthfully say that anymore because we have a federal judge. Even if Judge Torres is overturned on appeal, you still have a you know someone of the federal bench who's very serious who doesn't agree with you. So it's obviously not that clear. That much we can say. And so it really is now time for Congress to act. I've said this on Twitter, Sam, but you know, you can agree or disagree with the approach taken in the House bill or in the Senate bill. But you should engage. You should contact your representative, tell them you support this or you like it, but this or that. But you're a crypto voter. This is important to you. We think it's important to national security. We think it's important to our country. And we are, you know, we engage. There's absolutely no excuse or reason for the crypto community not to engage politically now. And, you know, look, different people will have different conclusions. My own conclusions about what is a good political solution here are my personal feelings, yours are yours, but there's no excuse not for engaging. And I think that's really the best outcome of all for me of Judge Torres' decision, which she makes it clear we should move now into the political arena. This is not an enforcement matter anymore. This is not people not are following the law. It's that we have a set of facts that don't fall neatly into any category. The crypto sales, because I think, you know, Sam, a lot of people in the wake of the decision yesterday said, but isn't it kind of weird and screwed up that a sophisticated institutional investor, you need to have be registered exempt, but you could sell on an exchange or a DEX and sell to retail and not have to worry about it. Isn't that a weird result? And yes, it is. It is a weird result. However, it is the law as it stands today. And the only answer is then we should change the law. We should have new ways. So, for example, on the House side, they propose sort of a Reg A type arrangement, which is like a mini IPO is what we call Reg A, to allow projects to crowdfund through an SEC sort of light registration process. Some people think that's a brilliant idea. Some people think it's not so good. Doesn't really matter. It's an idea and it's out there. The Lummis-Gillibrand bill goes in a slightly different direction than the Senate. But, you know, all these things have to be grappled with. And I think as we go into the weekend or the week, I guess, it's the time for, you know, people to reflect upon how do we want to, you know, engage around these questions.
And I think, frankly, Louis, we may want to do a whole segment later on just the set of bills that are moving through the House, because, I mean, there's so much to dig into there on both sides of the situation. I'm conscious of your time here, so I don't want to hold you too long. If you got to go, let me know. But the last thing that I want to ask you is that final category, right? Let's hit all four categories. So the fourth category here that was mentioned inside of the ruling was effectively the founders, right? So the core insiders, you know, and with respect to their own sales, et cetera. What were your feelings there? What was your takeaway on that?
Sure. So that's where the facts really kind of got a little bit tricky. And the judge said, you know, with respect to Both Larson and Garlinghouse, there was a material question as to whether they knew or recklessly disregarded the facts about the Howey elements. So they had a slightly different position, and she did, you know, so in order to make the other decisions after, you know, 2 years of fighting about the facts, the SEC and Ripple Labs ultimately agreed and stipulated to a set of facts. But as to Garlinghouse and Larson, she concluded that there was nothing that came close to agreement, and that would have to go to a trial. So whether they knew or recklessly disregarded the facts. And she said the same thing with respect to Larson in particular, about, because he was the CEO for a time, whether he consciously, after he left his role of CEO, I believe it was, whether he consciously assisted Ripple Labs in some active way. And she said there was just not enough. So for both of them, I think it's an important, the takeaway for me, Sam, here is that, you know, founders need to be very careful. One of the first questions we often get when we're working with startups is, okay, well, am I going to get personally in trouble, right? And, you know, we urge everybody to act in accordance with the law, you know, fully and honestly, but people nevertheless, where the law is not clear, worry about that. And I think, you know, the fact that this could go to trial as to Larson and Garlinghouse is an important reminder. You need to be careful, and you need to really conduct yourselves in a way that is consistent with legal policy, and don't, you know, YOLOing it can have results. You know, conceivably, both of them, depending on if they go to trial, could be responsible for some significant financial penalties. They've both done very well, you know, both through Ripple and other things, and they appear, best as anyone can tell from the outside, to be pretty wealthy, so they can probably make payments. However, many crypto startups who are listening to this aren't quite as wealthy as that, and, you know, if it was found that they were personally responsible, that they did really, you know, aid and abet the offenses of the company that sort of did an illegal token sale, they could be held responsible. So I think it is an important takeaway for founders and early stage folks to, you know, hire good counsel and really, you know, make sure you're doing everything you can to comply with the law.
Lewis, I love the both the nuanced and the balanced take here. And so it sounds like to me, you know, across the board as a participant across the industry, right, this is exciting news in one direction, right? We have at least, you know, some pushback on what has been historically a very, very unclear set of rules. And so it's interesting to at least see the feedback go back and forth in the actual federal courts at this point. And then at the same time, obviously the same rules always apply. Be careful, you know, actually follow the law to the letter of the law as prescribed. Frankly, probably retain good legal counsel. Lewis, I cannot thank you enough for coming on and chatting through this, especially you know, as quickly as it happened here. So we'll try to keep the viewers, you know, apprised of anything else that's going on. And I'd love to do another segment at some point on specifically both the Lummis Gillibrand bit as well as, you know, other House and Senate movements that we got going on.
You got it, Sam. Enjoy. Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show. Really appreciate it.
All right. See you around, Lewis.